Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Hi, I'm DW from Houston.
Hi, I'm Kristen from San Francisco.
Hi, I'm Graham from Vancouver, Canada.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did. It's easy.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate. Yes!
I'm Jesse Thorne. Coming up, I'll talk to a man who's a master of the accordion. Also, not a bad rapper. It's Weird Al Yankovic.
I don't know where the skill comes from. I think it comes from just a lot of unwarranted confidence in myself.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I talk to Weird Al about his multi-decade career in song parody. From Another One Rides the Bus to Eat It to White and Nerdy. Find out how it all started.
I don't think I ever had any aspirations to be cool. I thought that was sort of out of the question. You know, I just wanted to amuse my friends.
Plus, Jeff Nunberg explores the meaning of a word that we can't say on the radio. Suffice it to say, it starts with an A and ends with old.
Dictionaries don't really give it much attention. Oh, it's a contemptible person. Well, there are a lot of people who are contemptible. Stalin was contemptible, but you probably wouldn't use the A word of him.
His book on the subject is now out in paperback. Plus, our rap contributor Andrew Nas tells us about some of his all-time favorite tracks. All that and more coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. I'm tempted to say that my first guest needs no introduction, except that right now it's occurring to me that this is radio and so you can't see him. He's Weird Al Yankovic, probably the greatest song parodist of all time. He sold more than 12 million records. Right now you can grab his new concert DVD and Blu-ray, Weird Al Live, The Alpocalypse Tour. Plus, he's got a new kids book coming out this month called My New Teacher and Me. I spoke with Weird Al in 2011. Weird Al, welcome to the show.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I hope that that ramp up was suitable.
You impressed me.
Okay.
I'm excited to be here.
Good, good. I know. I mean, it's got to be fun to be you. I got to tell you. I want to talk to you. Why don't we start by talking a little bit about your childhood? When you were like 15, 16 years old, did you want to make music that was funny, or did you want to make music that rocked and would make you a cool rock and roll guy?
I don't think I ever had any aspirations to be cool. I thought that was sort of out of the question. You know, I just wanted to amuse my friends. Yeah, I think maybe I went through a stage which lasted about 20 minutes where I was like trying to write, you know, a serious rock song or a serious pop song. And I wrote some just execrable lyrics, and I looked at them and said, no, this isn't going to work. My brain is too warped to take this seriously. I have to kind of follow my muse, which was kind of just to do demented music.
When did this – now, you used the phrase demented music, which is the descriptor for the music that was played on the Dr. Demento radio show, which was a popular syndicated FM radio show that was – sort of a clearinghouse for every type of novelty song and piece of funny music. When did you first hear that show?
I think when I was maybe about 12 years old, a friend of mine turned me on to it and said, there's this show that's on KMET Los Angeles, like FM station in LA. Sunday nights, 4 hours, he plays nothing but like weird, funny, crazy music. And I thought, well, that's right up my alley. And I started listening, and I was immediately hooked. It went on a little bit past my bedtime, so after lights were out, I would have the alarm clock radio under the covers, you know, and I'd be listening to the Funny Five or the Top Ten, and it was I listened to it religiously. I mean, it really was an important part of my life. And after a while, my friends were saying, "Well, why don't you record your own stuff and send it into the show?" And I thought, well, I could do that. And so I recorded myself singing along with my accordion. Just on a little tiny cassette tape recorder in my bedroom. I think it was the cassette for like $3 for $1. I mean, there was just even the stock was cheap. But I sent them to the Dr. Demento show, and to my utter amazement, he played those songs on the radio. I just could not fathom this this was happening. It was like just the stuff that I had just recorded in my bedroom was now being heard by the whole listenership of the Dr. Demento Show.
I want to play a little bit of one of the first songs that you sent to Dr. Demento. This is a song called Belvedere Cruisin'.
You have that? Wow.
The internet, my friend.
Oh, yes. Everything's on the internet. It's amazing.
Yeah. How old were you when you recorded this song and sent it in?
I was either 15 or 16, I think.
Wow. Well, let's hear a little bit of my guest, Weird Al Yankovic, in his very first song, Belvedere Cruisin'. That song, or think about that song, do you feel like you recognize a voice or a person that you later became as an artist?
Everything's gone downhill since Belvedere Cruisin'. I was so raw. That was so punk. You know, it was so feral and so intense. I don't think I've ever matched that intensity.
But sincerely, I mean, that is really, I think, the theme of that song. You know, it's a song about...
it's a love song about my parents' car, which, you know, I think every artist has one of those songs in their catalog.
It's also a song that has, I think, a classic Weird Al juxtaposition, which is essentially fronting like you're cool in the way that popular music does, and that being sort of reality checked by something very banal.
That's a very nice way to put that. Yes. Let's go with that.
Speaking of songs that have that theme, I want to play a little bit of your first big Dr. Demento hit, which is a song called Another One Rides the Bus.
Okay.
Riding in the bus down the boulevard on the pace was pretty packed. Couldn't find a seat, so I had to stand with the perverts in the back. It was smelling like a locker room. There was junk all over the floor. We're already packed in like sardines for stopping to pick up more. Look out! Another one rides the bus. Another one rides the bus. And another comes on, and another comes on.
Tell me a little bit about how you recorded this record.
That was Another One Rides the Bus was written very, very quickly. I think it was actually over a weekend where I went on a camping trip, actually, with Dr. Demento and a couple other friends. We'd actually become friends during my high school years because I would send him recordings and he'd play them, and we developed a bit of a relationship. He invited me and I think our friends Beefalo Bill and Damascus and other people who had been friends of the Dr. Demento Show to go on a little trip. And over that weekend, I think I dashed off the lyrics in like 20 minutes because the Queen song was a big hit on the radio. And I thought, oh, maybe he'll let me play the song on his show that Sunday night. And I told him about it, and he said, yeah, well, we'll have you debut during the top 10. So I had my accordion with me during the show. I got ready to play, and I said, anybody wants to make any funny noises while I'm playing, you'll feel free. Musical mic, you can do your hand flatulence sounds, and everybody else just, like, do whatever. I think we maybe practiced it once out in the hallway. And there was this guy that said, hey, you know, I'm a drummer. I could bang on your accordion case. And I said, yeah, that's great. So Dr. Mill introduced me, Alfred Yankovic, and his magic accordion, or however it was. And he turned on the mics, and we did Another One Rides the Bus.
Several miles ago, but I couldn't get to the door. There isn't any room for me to breathe. Now we're going to pick up more, yeah. Another One Rides the Bus. Another one rides the bus, and another comes on, and another comes on. Another one rides the bus, hey, he's gonna sit by you. Another one rides the bus.
And I didn't think anything of it other than, yeah, that went pretty well. And then I went back off to college because I was, I think, 19 years old at the time, and I was just on break from school. Went back to college, and about a week later, my roommate was telling me, oh, when I get back from class, he'd say, you know, there were some messages for you on the phone. There's some radio station in New Zealand that wants a copy of Another One Rides the Bus. And I was getting all these crazy messages from all around the world, people trying to figure out how to get a copy of the song. Because it was on the Dr. Demento Show, which was syndicated nationally, But, you know, the song really took on a life of its own. It was viral in the days before things went viral. I mean, people were just, you know, desperate to get a copy of this thing. So that was the beginning of it. It came out eventually, gosh, several months after the fact, after the bloom was far off the rose. But didn't quite get out in time to make any kind of real splash.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Weird Al Yankovic about his long career in song parody. What was the point that these dalliances in recording and performing became an earnest attempt at building a career that could pay your bills?
Probably not until after I graduated from college. I proceeded to try to, you know, take a shot at getting a bona fide record deal. And it was a period of a couple of years where, you know, I knocked on a lot of doors and sent a lot of tapes around. And the general response was, oh, this is really funny. You're very clever. And, it's possibly even genius. But, you know, we're not interested because this is novelty music. And if you're lucky, maybe you'll have another hit single or something. But we're looking for people, you know, to have long careers. And, this is just not the genre that we want to be involved with.
What were you listening to in the 1980s when you were first building your career?
I've always been kind of drawn to, well, of course, like there's the Dr. Demento artists, which inspired me in the first place. But I was, in terms of contemporary artists, I was really inspired by the whole new wave scene, which was, I guess it's more like late 70s. But the B-52s and Devo and Oingo Boingo, Talking Heads, things like that. And that kind of carried over into the 80s a bit as well. But yeah, anything that was a little quirky and left to center, I took a lot of inspiration from that.
This was a time when the music landscape was really changing a lot. Just as it had in the 1970s with the sort of advent of FM album-oriented rock radio, it was changing the 1980s into a world that was driven by new radio formats and also MTV that had video. What was the first, like, real studio-produced attempt that you made that really worked?
The first album that we did was done on spec. It was produced by Rick Derringer, and I should probably explain how that came about. I get permission when I do the parodies, and one of the parodies that I was recording was a parody of Joan Jett's hit "I Love Rock and Roll,"
which correct me if I'm wrong, was "I Love Rocky Road."
That is correct, sir. Now that was a cover version for her. That was originally done by a group called the Arrows. And one of the gentlemen in the Arrows who also co-wrote the song was Jay Cooker, who happened to be Rick Derringer's manager.
I hear those ice cream bells and I start to drool. Keep a couple quarts in my locker at school. Yeah, the chocolate's getting old. Vanilla just leaves me cold. There's just one flavor good enough for me. Yeah, me. Don't give me no crummy teaspoon. I know what I need. Baby, I love Rocky Road. So won't you go and buy half a gallon, baby? I love Rocky Road. So have another triple scope with me.
Oh, was that your first genuine real-life radio smash?
Well, there was a demo of that song that came out before the album. It's sort of like we were trying to get... We recorded the first album on spec very, very quickly, very cheaply, and I would say sort of poorly. But you know, it was a product of its time. But we had the demo of the song, which we kind of leaked to Los Angeles radio, and it actually got a fair amount of airplay on a couple of the top 40 stations. And we used that exposure to create the buzz that would, you know, we hoped would get us a record deal. And again, you know, we were still having a tough time from all the record companies. They all thought that, you know, this was novelty. This is not something we want to dirty our hands with. And finally, a company called Scotty Brothers decided they would take a shot at it.
When I'm all alone, I just grab myself a comb. And if I get fat and lose my teeth, that's fine with me.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne, and my guest is Weird Al Yankovic. He's got a new kids book coming out this month called My New Teacher and Me. You can also check out his recent concert DVD and Blu-ray. It's called Weird Al Live, The Alpocalypse Tour. We spoke in 2011, shortly before the Alpocalypse album was released. Your albums are often roughly half original compositions and half parody songs. usually with a polka medley thrown in. And I want to play one of your earlier or successful original compositions, which is called Biggest Ball of Twine in Minnesota.
Okay.
Well, I had 2 weeks of vacation time coming after working all year down at Big Roy's Heating and Plumbing. So one night when my family and I were gathered round the dinner table, I said, kids, if you could go anywhere in this great big world now, where'd you like to go to? They said, Dad, we want to see the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. They picked the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota.
This is another one of your tunes. This one, an original that is about that sense of kind of suburban banality. I wonder how you felt about that in a time when, in the early and mid 1980s, when there was sort of this buzz of satire of that, like attacks upon that, that was left over from punk rock in part, and also an ironic celebration of camp, which was at the time just kind of making it into the mainstream.
Right. I mean, there was certainly a lot of, you can read a lot into my body of work. I think the irony plays a lot into it. And certainly there's a theme running through my songs of celebrating banality, which I just kind of wanted to, you know, I'm sort of alternative music as it is. But, you know, everybody else was writing songs about love and loftier themes. And, you know, I thought that to stand out, I could be writing songs about lunch meat and or twine balls or whatever the case may be. And just celebrating the minutiae of everyday life.
I was thinking of Eat It, which was I'm 29. So that was a big thing in my childhood. Eat It. Both Beat It and Eat It. I worshipped Michael Jackson and I loved Eat It. And I was thinking about how that is just simply about the simplest thing it could possibly be about.
Yes. I'm thankful that there was no YouTube in 1984, because otherwise there would have already been 10 million Eat It parodies before I ever got around to it.
It really takes this most basic human function and just explodes it into absurd opera, the absurd opera of pop music that pop music is often.
Right. I did a lot of songs about food, especially in the 80s, and I'm not really sure why. Food just seemed like a really easy thing to write songs about. It might be a leftover from my days as a starving musician. I don't know. But it's come in handy because now, because I have written so many songs about food, I can totally write off any kind of food that I eat. Like my grocery bill, that's a tax write-off, because, you know, I need it for inspiration for my songs, really.
In the early 1990s, there was a huge push against that pop excess that you had parodied so successfully in the 1980s. The kind of, you know, frivolous Debbie Gibson songs that made a great target for you were suddenly the target of the songs that were on the radio as alternative rock became a huge phenomenon. How did you feel about alternative rock when it sort of exploded the pop music world in, you know, 1991 or 1992?
I was a big fan of alternative music. I mean, I was thrilled when Nirvana became a big hit. When they first came on the scene, my first thought was I would love to do a parody of these guys, but, you know, they're never going to be mainstream enough for me to make fun of. And then when their album went to number one, I was thrilled, and thankfully Kurt and the guys had a great sense of humor about the whole thing. But I was a big fan. I mean, the 90s were a great time in music. I mean, I like real instruments. I like guitars. I like the whole DIY aesthetic, and I like, you know, I like actual bands. And that, yeah, that the whole indie and alternative scene, I think, was a lot of fun. And I was great to see that, you know, pop culture kind of take a dip into that area for a while.
It's a very different aesthetic than some of those new wave bands that you talked about admiring, like Oingo Boingo or Devo, who were often at their core about satirizing things, about having fun and being funny, sometimes in a campy way, sometimes in a satirical way, you know, various ways. Alternative rock was not what you would generally describe as humorous.
Well, maybe not generally, but I mean, they certainly had humorous alternative bands. I mean, there's a lot of I don't want to give you a laundry list of names, but I mean, my favorite bands of the time were, well, just as one example, the President of the United States of America. I mean, they're part of the Seattle scene, part of the alternative scene, but, you know, there's certainly a lot of humor in their songs. And again, a lot of their material was celebrating banality, much like my material was. So I definitely found some kindred spirits in that scene.
Let's hear a little bit of alternative polka. One of my guests, Weird Al Yankovic's legendary polka medleys of popular music. This of the popular music of the early 1990s. Yeah, after a break, I'll talk to Weird Al about rap. He's not that bad at it. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Production of Bullseye is supported in part by Amazon Publishing, with American Spirit, the debut novel from Dan Kennedy about a 40-something man and his comedic vision quest along the edges of modern American living. Available now.
Bullseye's on Twitter. Follow us online at twitter.com/bullseye.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne, and my guest is Weird Al Yankovic. He's got a new kids book coming out this month called My New Teacher and Me. You can also check out his recent concert DVD and Blu-ray. It's called Weird Al Live, The Alpocalypse Tour. We spoke in 2011, shortly before the Alpocalypse album was released.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity. At 4:30 in the morning, I'm milking cows.
In the 1990s, you started to do parody songs of hip-hop records. And to that point, most of the parodies of hip-hop that were out there were, from the perspective of a person that actually likes rap music, very sort of disrespectful and sort of ham-fisted, and reduced this genre of music to a kind of insulting, childlike sing-song baloney, which which spoke to the parodists' sort of misunderstanding of it as a thing in the world.
Are you talking about Rappin' Rodney or Rappin' Reagan?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were dozens and dozens of those records, and I didn't think any of them were much of anything.
Most of them were based on the joke of, isn't this funny, there's a white guy trying to rap?
Yeah, exactly. So when you first approached hip-hop in songs like Amish Paradise, which was the early 1990s and a huge hit, another huge hit that I remember from my own childhood. What was your perspective on what had been done and what could be done?
I try to just basically ignore most of those examples that you mentioned. The primary joke was not that, you know, here's some like goofy white guy trying to do a kind of a cool musical genre. I basically respected the music and treated it like I would any other pop song, and tried to emulate the style as closely as I could. And I tried to make the jokes be jokes that were contained in the actual lyrics, as opposed to like, you know, isn't this crazy what I'm doing?
You know, one thing that I was always impressed by is that you're really not a bad rapper.
Well, thanks.
And rapping is kind of hard. I know that I could not successfully rap. Tell me a little bit about the work that's involved in achieving the level of competence that is needed in order to make a successful parody.
You know, that's a hard one to answer because I don't know. Thank you first for the compliments, but I don't know where the skill comes from. I think it comes from just a lot of unwarranted confidence in myself and just the desire to just try anything and keep doing it until I get competent at it. So I don't know. I mean, I never certainly considered myself a rapper, but I am a musician. So in terms of rap, I can figure out like, okay, there's, you know, these syllables need to be eighth notes and this one has to be a quarter note. And I figure it out musically and then I just give it my best shot.
Let's play a little bit of White and Nerdy, one of your more recent hip hop parody hits.
MIT. Got skills, I'm a champion of D&D. MC Escher, that's my favorite MC. Keep your 40 out, just have an Earl Grey tea. My rims never spin, to the contrary. You'll find that they're quite stationary. All of my action figures are cherry. Stephen Hawking's in my library. My MySpace page is all totally pimped out. Got people begging for my top 8 spaces. Yo, I know pie to 1,000 places. Ain't got no grills, but I still wear braces. I order all of my sandwiches with mayonnaise. I'm a whiz, a minesweeper, I can play for days. Once you see my sweet moves, you're gonna stay amazed. My fingers moving so fast, I set the place ablaze. There's no killer rap I haven't run. At Pascal, well, I'm number one. Do vector calculus just for fun. I ain't got a gap, but I got a soldering gun. Happy Days is my favorite theme song. I could sure kick your butt in a game of ping pong. I'll ace any trivia quiz you bring on. I'm fluent in JavaScript as well as Klingon. The part I sing on.
You see me roll on my Segway. I know in my heart they think I'm white and nerdy.
That was White and Nerdy from my guest, Weird Al Yankovic. Do you like to listen to parody? Is parody a form that like intrigues you as a consumer of media?
I try not to listen to a lot of other parody artists. I mean, there are a lot on YouTube, and I'm aware that they exist. But I try not to expose myself to that because I don't want to be unduly influenced. I try to be aware just because, you know, I wouldn't want to tread ground that's been tread before, if at all possible. That's becoming more and more difficult every year given the nature of portals like YouTube. But I still enjoy comedy music. I still enjoy satire. But I try not to expose myself to a lot of other actual parody songs.
I want to play a little bit of a song that you released on the internet. It's called Skipper Dan, and it's a really uncharacteristically sweet, sad,
it's bittersweet, yeah,
version of your typical sense of humor. Here's Weird Al Yankovic in Skipper Dan.
I was sure that Tarantino would be calling me on the phone. Any leave of it that you be for Rolling Stone. But the years have come and gone, and I'm sorry to say that's not the way that it's all worked out. I'm a tour guide on the Jungle Cruise ride. Skipper Dan is the name, and I'm doing 34 shows every day. Every time it's the same.
Tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write that song about broken dreams.
I think that I was actually on a Jungle Cruise ride with my family at Disneyland, and the skipper made just some kind of offhanded comment about his failed acting career, and a light bulb immediately went off, and I thought, well, that's a whole song right there. I mean, I could kind of visualize this whole sad character's life full of broken dreams. And, you know, again, Skipper Dan is not one of my really laugh-out-loud kind of funny songs, but I thought it was a really interesting character study and something that that I enjoyed taking on.
Were there things that you sort of left by the wayside, your own dreams that you abandoned in order to pursue this amazing career as a parodist?
Not at all. I'm living the dream. This is I feel, you know, I can't imagine anything else I'd rather be doing, frankly. I mean, comedy and music have always been my passions, and I still can't believe that I've been able to make a living at it all these years.
Are you surprised that now, as you essentially enter middle age, you are not only still in the midst of a career, but essentially as successful, as high in the music industry now as you have ever been?
That's a great feeling, because most artists that have been lucky enough to have a career that's lasted a few decades, when they do their live shows and they say, here's something from the new album, that's usually the bathroom break. That's like, okay, we'll be back in 20 minutes. And I'm very fortunate that, you know, every album that I put out is as vital and as popular as anything in my back catalog. My last album was ostensibly my most popular album of my career. It's the first one to chart in the Billboard Top 10. White and Nerdy surpassed Eat It as being my most popular single. It sold over a million legal downloads, and I don't know how many illegal ones, but I'm quite a few, I bet. But I mean, it's a pretty heady thing to realize that this far into my career, I'm actually sort of peaking.
Weird Al Yankovic. He's got a new kids book coming out this month. It's called My New Teacher and Me. He's also on a summer tour with his band through August. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week on our show, we're joined by one of our favorite critics to recommend stuff that's worth your time. And this week, we get a couple of all-time favorites from our hip-hop critic, Andrew Nas. Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
Hey, Jesse.
So your first pick is by two of my favorite rappers, DJ Quick with a guest verse from Ludacris. The song's called Pacific Coast Remix, and it's off DJ Quick's 2005 album, Trauma. Well, my baby mama is, because she see having kids as a tool for getting chips. That's with or without the chips. She told my lawyer she's a nurse, but she can't spell school. Quite frankly, she's me up for the fool. Idiot. Welcome to the city where you might see things like real threats, fake breasts. Negativity hangs over the city like a puppet string pulling you up. You think they love you till the director yells cut. Now they're packing you with ice and zipping you up.
So I think, like a lot of DJ Quick songs, it has what you might call a barbecue beat. But DJ Quick, later in his career, in the past 5 and 10 years, has been a lot more comfortable getting into personal and relatively dark subjects. I think that's one of the interesting things about this song.
I think, on the whole, he was kind of trying to say a lot about L.A. You know, everybody always thinks of the glamour and, you know, the sunniness and all that. But, you know, Quick came from a very dark side of L.A. culture, and I think maybe he glorified that a little bit on his early releases, but with this one, he just kind of looked around and was like, man, this is a mess. Like, as nice as everything looks out here, you know, it's just a mess.
Let's talk about one of the early classics of avant-garde hip-hop. This song is called Beat Bop. It's from 1983. It's by Rammel Z and K-Rob. This is the mellow they call the rail bell. The rockster with the rhythm that a shock can spell. When the shake up kick, the wakes you up in the morning. Gotta rear with the rhythm like a number one groaning. MC Quick, just to make your peanut butter. Shock with the rhythm, I'm a number one undercover. Break it up, just shake it up, rodeo. Break it up, just shake it up, rodeo. I'm the mellow.
melody down with the funky sound that can make you break with my diamond studded crown. Just so making you jump like a little bit of dive, like a rat, just so making you hide. Crack on to the break of dawn, just freaking, yeah, baby, just freaking, yeah, baby.
So one thing that I think people forget about the history of hip-hop is that in the early 1980s especially, there was a real uptown-downtown connection in the hip-hop world with graffiti artists showing at galleries and, you know, Debbie Harry rapping and all of that stuff. And this record is, I think, sort of a reflection of that confluence of worlds, as well as in Ramelsey, just a totally distinctive one-of-a-kind hip-hop figure.
Yeah, definitely. Ramelsey, I think, was kind of representative of this sort of 80s hip-hop renaissance man. That I mean, Ramelsey was a rapper, you know, he was a visual artist, he was an actor sometimes. He's just a fascinating figure, and he was also one of the great hip-hop artists where you weren't sure if he was completely brilliant or completely insane. Which, I mean, to me, that's kind of the mark of a great hip-hop artist. Like, you don't... You know, absolute sanity does not often result in great hip-hop. maybe I'm speaking to my personal preference, where I just like people who can toe that line between, you know, where you don't really know how far off the deep end they are.
Andrew Nas is the blogger behind Cocaine Blunts and the great Tumblr Tumblin' Herb. He's also a columnist at Pitchfork and writes for numerous other music magazines. His recommendations this week: Ramelsey and K-Rob's Beat Bop from 1983 and DJ Quick featuring Ludacris, Pacific Coast Remix. From DJ Quick's album Trauma. Thanks, Andrew. After a break, I'll talk to Jeff Nunberg about a word we can't say on the radio. It starts with A, and it means real son of a gun. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hey, everybody. My name is Dave Shumka.
And I'm Graham Clark.
And we are the hosts of a show called Stop Podcasting Yourself right here on the MaximumFun.org network.
We're the first ever Canadian podcast to win a Canadian Comedy Award for Best Podcast.
I think we went with that too early. I think we seem braggy.
It's a weekly comedy show, a very easygoing chat between Dave, myself, guests. We'll talk about things that we've overheard during the week and also Hulk Hogan.
Stop podcasting yourself. Head over to MaximumFun.org to download an episode today.
Hey, gang. You can subscribe to the Bullseye Podcast at MaximumFun.org.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest Jeff Nunberg is best known to public radio listeners as Fresh Air's resident linguist. He also teaches at Berkeley and is emeritus chair of the American Heritage Dictionary's usage panel. His recent book is called Ascent of the A-Word. I'm going to say the full title now, which we will have to bleep. Ascent of the A-Word, A-lism, the first 60 years. The book is available now in paperback. We spoke last year. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So this book is about the A word. If you don't know what the A word is, it rhymes with bass bowl, which is also a lunch special at KFC.
Right.
And you write that word, the A word, is about more than just what it is defined as in dictionary. So maybe you could tell us what it's defined as in a dictionary and then why that meaning isn't its actual meaning.
Well, it's one of those words I think of as being so beneath our consideration. We use it. We don't really give it much thought. If you ask people what it means, they're going to give you a list of names, not a dictionary entry. And even as I noted in the book, dictionaries don't really give it much attention. They say, oh, it's a contemptible person, the Oxford English Dictionary. Well, there are a lot of people who are contemptible. Stalin was contemptible, but you probably wouldn't use the A word of him. Osama bin Laden was certainly contemptible. You wouldn't use the A word of him.
In fact, when you were describing the variety of people that were contemptible that you wouldn't describe as an A word, I was thinking of alternative comedy to humanize and personalize something so grandly evil is actually like a common joke. Like to say something like calling Stalin an a-hole is so incongruous as to be funny on stage.
And it's precisely incongruous, if you'll forgive me delving into the comedy, but it's precisely incongruous because it's a word we use for members of our own tribe, for people we're familiar with. We have familiarity and contempt are connected proverbially in English. And to use the A word of somebody is to suggest not that just that person's contemptible, but that we can talk about why it's he's the jerk down the block who gets on your case when you don't take your garbage out in the morning or something. He's a very specific type. You can earn the A word label for cheating on your wife, for example. Probably not for cheating on your income tax. You can earn it for cutting off somebody in a left turn lane, but maybe not for texting while you drive. You can earn it for stealing ideas from your colleagues, maybe not for plagiarizing from a published book. If George W. Bush earned the label, which some people think he did, it wasn't for anything he said about weapons of mass destruction. It was for the way he smirked at the press. So it has a much, much more specific meaning than the dictionaries or your firsthand intuitions would let you think. And it has a specific meaning. And it's a word that appears in the language at a certain point. It's a word with a meaning that we've never really had. It covers ground that other words covered, but they're united in a new way by this word. And the point I wanted to make in the book is that that's a signal of very basic changes in our social attitudes. The word is born in World War II in the mouths of GIs who use it for officious, overbearing officers above all. The first military leader to be labeled with a word by both his men and his superiors is George Patton, not surprisingly, if you know the real Patton, not just the movie Patton.
So the classic a-hole that you describe in this book is a guy who has a lot of airline points and cuts the line at the airline ticket counter when somebody's flight gets delayed and asks for special treatment. And everyone in the line says, oh, what an A-word that guy is.
Right. They don't say how uncivil.
Yeah.
It's the word that we instinctively use as a reproach for incivility. It's also an uncivil word. And I think the interesting thing about this word is that it both instances this incivility that everybody's worried about, and it also instances the concern about incivility that everybody expresses. And it's an indication of how much those two are wrapped up with each other and how much we are ourselves the problem.
There's a sort of blithe self-regard that's involved in the particular rude, arrogant incivilities that an A-word exemplifies.
Blithe self-regard is very good. I think of it as obtuseness. The example I give, actually, of the perfect example is a real story that a friend of mine told me. He's a Texan. He's in New York on 9/11. He's freaked out, as a lot of people are. He's got to get home to his family. He gets money from an ATM. He goes over to the Hertz office on West 43rd Street. There's a huge crowd of people there with the same thought he has. The clerks are beleaguered. This little guy walks in, pushes to the front of the room, pulls out his wallet and says, excuse me, where's the gold card line? Everybody in that room was thinking the same three-word sentence that ended with the A word. And the interesting thing about this is the extraordinary obtuseness of imagining that the credential you have in your wallet, a little gold card, trumps the extraordinary events of that day. It's an obtuseness. It's imagining that your qualification entitles you to things that it doesn't entitle you to. And moreover, it's not really malignant. There's nothing evil or mean about this guy. He's not hurting anybody. He's just being a jerk in this case. And in particular, this kind of obtuse person who merits the A word.
The A word is also fundamentally vulgar because it's about butts.
And I wonder if you could tell me what the significance of that fact is, because heel and bounder and cat and scoundrel and all of those other words, none of them have anything to do with what in broadcasting standards are called sexual and excretory functions, right?
Right, right.
The
right.
things besides blasphemy that you can't do on the public airwaves. Cad, bounder, all those things are not about that. There's no talk about people's special places.
So to say the A word is to violate the kind of inhibition that you learn very early. The inhibition about using these words shows up by the time you're five and you're taking a salacious pleasure in saying shampoo. Now, that pleasure and the idea that it's a dirty word and you get to say it here and the way in which the stigma is attached to the very syllable so that it's retained even if you embed that syllable in another word, all of those principles you've learned by the time you're four or five. And the idea that, well, if we could overcome our bourgeois hang-ups with these words, wouldn't be that, it's like trying to overcome the other stuff you learned when you're four or five. It can't be done. And for that reason, when I use that word of somebody, I might be doing several. If I use it to somebody's face, I'm saying, you are so contemptible that I feel no obligation to respect the inhibitions and conventions that normally apply in this situation. Or my emotions are so strong that they're overcoming those inhibitions. And I'm not simply saying that. I'm demonstrating it by breaking a rule, by breaking a very basic inhibition. That's why the word creates also a kind of solidarity.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Jeffrey Nunberg. His book is called Ascent of the A-Word. It's available now in paperback. We spoke last year. One of the interesting things to me about the rise of this word is the timing, which you write about very eloquently in the book, which is that it is created during World War II, but it really gets going in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And it's parallel to a couple of big cultural movements. But one of them is that I think the vulgarity of the A word is tied in with the vulgarity of other longshoremen's parlance, to use a phrase that is often used, and frankly, I am not sure I know what a longshoreman is. That is where I know what longshoreman's parlance is. I know it has something to do with docks, but that's about it. So it's in 1970, young people are using vulgar language in the same way that they were growing their hair long or not wearing neckties. It both rejects the authority of those in authority, the people who say you shouldn't use vulgar language, and identifies them, whether or not they are of the proletariat, with the proletariat in a way that is important for their value systems.
Yeah, no, I think it's very well put. The word is used in the 60s. When I was an undergraduate in the 60s, people used the word. I thought it was kind of cool to use the word, which indicates that it wasn't quite there yet. The movement left uses it a lot. And swearing in general has that political subversive meaning. If you think of the scene in Woodstock where Country Joe McDonald of Country Joe and the Fish is singing, and he's singing that song, Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die, rag, you know, 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Who cares? I don't give a damn. Next step is Vietnam. And he starts off with a call and response. The mere mention of that word became a political act in that context. You didn't have to say that word of anybody. Didn't need an object. Just the verb alone would do it. By the 70s, the lifestyle and behavior and values that had been subversive and challenging to the established order in the 60s are domesticated and given a kind of conventional non-conventional meaning, so to speak. So the long hair that was really troubling on the hippies, if you read those Wall Street Journal editorials, they're unslovenly long hair, is now just a feature of everybody in the high school yearbook, long hair on men. Jeans. Everybody's wearing jeans to the point where by the mid-70s, people are wearing, you know, Gloria Vanderbilt is making jeans for people. The informality of address. This is when people start calling their professors Bob, you know. And the use of this vulgar language becomes a conventional way of indicating that you're not bound by these uptight, formal, bourgeois proprieties, even in the midst of them, even if you're working for a big corporation.
You know, when you wrote about Country Joe's call and response at Woodstock, what that F-U-C dot, dot, dot made me think of more than anything else is the rebranding of the clothing retailer, the French Connection, into F-C-U-K in order to get, like, what's left of that charge in the probably literally the least subversive context imaginable.
Right. No, it's interesting to me. For this language to work, when you learn this language, when you're a kid, you have to learn two things to learn with these. First of all, you have to be told that we don't say those words. One does not say those words. And then you have to hear people saying the words, ideally the same people. You know, the best thing is to hear it from to be told we don't say them and then to hear your dad saying it. You know, that then you really learn the lesson about it. And then you can take that salacious pleasure in the schoolyard of saying it, knowing you're breaking a rule. And we need both. We need the prudes. We need that town in Massachusetts a while ago that passed a law against public profanity. Everybody's indignant. But it's great to know those people are out there because those are the people we have in mind when we use the words. If there were no such people left out there, we couldn't have the pleasure of using the words, knowing how indignant it made them. And
dancing's no fun without footloose laws.
Right. Right. And so that play between the inhibition and the violation of the inhibition is at the core of what these words do for us.
I went to college at the University of California in Santa Cruz and grew up in San Francisco. And in my time in perhaps the two most liberal places in the entire world, like probably even more than like Maoist Beijing, I saw a lot of the kind of political discourse that you describe in this book. And it strikes me that there are slightly different tones to the a-holism of a conservative and the a-holism of a liberal when those two a-holisms are clashing. That snobs versus slobs tone has been a really important part of why conservatives have in some cases announced that they don't need to care about anything that liberals have to say because they're all effete, ivory tower, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. But on the left, there's a slightly different but no less virulent version of a-holism.
Yeah, no, and in some ways they almost come together. For the right, the a-holes are these pretentious, effete, self-important, out of touch, West Side Hollywood academic media liberals,
right.
who, as you say, don't have to be paid anywhere. They're contemptible. You don't have to pay any respect to them. You can say ridiculous things. In fact, the point of the game often is just to take pleasure at the thought of the indignation that you're engendering in those people. When Ann Coulter says the 9/11 widows were enjoying their husband's deaths, I mean, she doesn't care about those women. It's not as if she cares one way or the other, but she knows how indignant they're going to be. Hillary Clinton says heartless. You know, it's exactly the reaction she's looking for. And the people listening to her take pleasure in the thought of how outrageous she's being and how you can get away with being outrageous. There is a pleasure in this.
I mean, that's you're describing what Rush Limbaugh has done, has made him the most popular radio personality in the world in the United States for the last 20 years, that he is constantly engaged in a self-aware, basically, act of bear baiting, you know, that he does not care about the literal meaning of what he's saying because the abstracted or, you know, you could say satirical meaning in some cases is just to upset people, is just to demonstrate, look at these stupid people and what they get upset about.
And to take pleasure in that as I mean, the principle that we learn from Dirty Harry is that we can take an enormous pleasure in watching somebody do really terrible things to people who have it coming. And that's what Dirty Harry does. It's what Woody Allen does in his way, or John Belushi does in his way. It's what Rush Limbaugh or Ann Coulter does. Now, you're talking about the left. Yeah, it's there on the left as well. I certainly don't think that the distribution of people who merit this label respects political boundaries, though the right tends to be better organized about it.
So I want to ask you about the male-female part of this. A-hole and the A-word in general is
overwhelmingly attached to men rather than women. So maybe you could tell me why you think that is, what are the factors that lead into that, and whether there are other words that we use for women, whether they mean the same thing.
Yeah, I think there are two reasons. One of them is legitimate and the other's not. The first is that why do we use the A word more of men than women? Because more men deserve it. Right? Because why? Because it tends to be used to people who have higher status. And in this world, it's still the case that a disproportionate number of the people who are bosses and have authority and so on are men. That makes sense. It's also the case that men tend to be the ones who confuse their status with their sense of self. They're the ones who go around saying, do you know who I am? And, of course, people who say, do you know who I am? Almost never know themselves. But they imagine – take the boss in the office in both the American and British versions, who's a perfect example of this. And, again, a perfect example because he's really not maligned. There's nothing nasty about him or mean-spirited. He's just clueless and obtuse about his own role. He's an example of that, somebody who thinks that his status as the boss entitles him to meddle in the lives of his employees or demand things of him that he really doesn't have a right to demand and so on. On the other hand, it's often the case that when a man does something that would merit that label, yelling at the gate agent for not giving him an upgrade, when we see a woman doing the same thing, we don't use the same label. We call her a bitch. As if suddenly this didn't have to do with a swollen sense of entitlement, which is usually what it is, but rather with some primordial feminine malevolence that's, you know, inborn and so on. It becomes a sex-linked thing. Well, it's not a sex-linked thing. Women are capable of the same swollen sense of entitlement as men. And if it's – yeah, it's not like some of the other names based on the male member, which where this restriction to men is – understandable. So I think we should use the A word for women more than we do. Look, if
that's going to be our poll quote.
if Eddie Fisher merits the A word label for ditching Debbie Reynolds for Elizabeth Taylor, why does she not get the label when she ditches Fisher for Richard Burton? What's the difference? I think the fact that we go to the B word, where we'd use the A word for men, is indicative of a kind of residual sexism that, again, these words can make known in a way that other words can't, because we'll very quickly revise our use of gal or girls or something like that, knowing that that's not the way we do it now, where these other words go more deeply to our actual feelings.
Well, as Bono once said, Jeffrey, having you on the show was really awesome. Jeffrey Nunberg's great, trenchant, fascinating book is called Ascent of the A-Word, A-Holism, the First 60 Years. He spells it out. I can only have so many beeps in one radio show. Jeffrey, thanks for coming back on Bullseye.
Thanks.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week we close the show with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. Right now, the late-night talk show's in a bit of a golden age. There's Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert on Comedy Central, of course. Jimmy Fallon has done a brilliant job of capitalizing on his particular brand of charm, especially considering the boundaries of network television. Craig Ferguson actually talks to people like human beings, which is kind of amazing. Conan's taken his new cable gig as an opportunity to be, you know, more Conan-y than ever, which is great. And his show has the distinction of being the only late-night show that actually seems to consider whether the guests are, you know, funny, entertaining. But here's the truth. All of the people that I mentioned are brilliantly talented, and there's others besides. But there's only one real genius in late night, and his name is David Letterman.
From New York, the greatest city in the world, it's The Late Show with David Letterman.
All those folks are funny. David Letterman is a transformative figure. He's the one who still does something once in a while that's amazing. Not just funny or clever or sharp, but genuinely marvelous. Look, Dave's in his mid-60s. He usually seems pretty disinterested in the monologue. He's often borderline resentful of the top 10 list. When a guest gets boring, he gets a little bored. But the fact is that Letterman's so good, he's still better than most when he's running at 80%. He's like a veteran pitcher. He hits the corners, he changes speeds, he holds a little something back. But when there's two strikes, he will blow you away. Because he's the best in the business, and that's what he does. Dave doesn't often leave the studio these days. Once in a while, they'll send a camera out and have him direct the action on the street. I particularly loved a segment called How Many Spider-Mans Fit in a Jamba Juice, which you should definitely watch on the internet. He'll still do something silly, even if it confuses the audience. Lately, he's been having a couple of faux morning anchors do plugs for the Late Show Weekend. Sometimes a weird guy wanders onto the set to say something weird. Most often, though, Letterman's genius shows in the little moments. Talking from the desk about a trip he took with his son, or interacting with an old friend like Regis Philbin, or with a genuine madman like Jungle Jack Hanna, or maybe a world champion grocery bagger or a child bird caller. It's in those little moments that he shows you something that you can't quite explain, something so good that it leaves you awestruck. Look, all these folks in late night are talented. Some of them are extremely talented. And probably some of their shows are cooler or hotter or more consistently amusing or incisive or whatever. But when they get home at 11 or 11:30, I think they watch Dave. Because Dave is the genius. That's my out chat.
How you doing? Thank you. Hey, seriously, how many of you just came here to cool off, huh? Yeah.
That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer is Nick White. Our intern is Thomas Matisek. Interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Bullseye's theme music is provided by The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label, Memphis Industries. You can find this show and all past Bullseye shows for free at MaximumFun.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast. Podcast, by the way, often features longer versions of each week's interviews. We just had a fantastic time at Max FunCon this weekend. Thanks so much to everybody who joined us. We hope we'll see you there next year. Be sure to go to boatparty.biz if you'd like to join us for our next big event, the Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival. It's happening in September. That's boatparty.biz. Yes, really, boatparty.biz. We have not yet heard from Sugar Ray lead singer Mark McGrath, but I'd want to take this opportunity to repeat my offer. We feel bad that your Mark McGrath and Friends cruise got canceled, and so if you want to come on our cruise, the Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival, you can, on me. Just send me an email. My email address is jesse@MaximumFun.org. And if you're not Mark McGrath, but you know Mark McGrath, let him know. I think he's going to want to know about this. It's going to be a lot of fun. jesse@MaximumFun.org, Mark. Let's do this. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.